Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for joining us today. You know, it's interesting, at least my language has changed a bit as I talk about what used to be called Election Day, the day that we vote. That happens next Tuesday, May 24th. But so many people for a few years now have been voting by absentee ballot or going out and doing advance voting in person that I now think a week from today is what we should call the final day of voting in the Georgia primary elections. Excuse me. We're going to talk about the extraordinary number of people who have cast ballots already and what some think it may mean, especially about Republican contests. We'll do that and a lot more on the show today. We start with our Tuesday partner from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the AJC. How are you, Tamar?
Hey, Bill. Excited to be here.
Are you one of those advance voting people, or do you like to go to the... I'm, for the first time, going on Election Day for the first time in a long time because I really love seeing some of my neighbors, elderly people mostly, who come out and staff the polls.
Yeah, in general, I like to vote early since Election Day is such a hectic day for us political reporters. So one less thing to do. And in general, you know, as a reporter, as a political reporter, I actually don't, I choose not to vote in primaries since I cover a lot of these candidates. But you talk to each journalist and everyone kind of has their own answer about what they like to do. Some don't vote at all. I tend to vote in generals. Some people vote and it doesn't really bother them. So that's kind of where I land on primaries.
Margaret Coker, editor-in-chief of The Current, the online news publication, I'm curious about your thinking about that. I know there is that notion that maybe journalists shouldn't vote in primary elections. I always have felt that it was a responsibility to do that, but where do you feel about that?
Yep, I am a journalist. I'm also an American and a Georgian resident, and voting is my civic right just as much as it is for every other Georgian. So yes, I go and vote. Because Georgia is an open primary state, I feel like that all of us here can choose choose the people that we want to represent us at every stage of the process. And in general, I am an early voter as well, because I don't want to miss out on that chance to vote and cast my ballot. And voting day generally, as Tamar said, is a busy one for those of us in the journalism trenches. So, but yeah, I feel like where things start to cross the line is if I am a voter on election day and I need to get people's opinions, I can't do that while I'm standing in line. And so early voting means I can then do my job without any impediment on voting day or final voting day, as you've called it.
Tia Mitchell, I'll introduce you in a sec, but let me just say to our listeners, I guess what we should explain what we're talking about here. There are people who believe that because you have to choose a Democratic, Republican ballot, whatever, that you're making a partisan choice, which is why there are some people who think journalists in primary elections should stay free. Tia Mitchell, I, instead of asking you about that, want to instead congratulate you. Last week, you won a very prestigious award, the David Lynch Award for Regional Reporters. You won the award at the Washington Press Club Foundation evening last week. It's an award that is given for incisive coverage, clear writing, and an ability to explain complex subjects to a hometown audience. David Lynch was a longtime Washington correspondent for newspapers in Buffalo and New England. It's a tremendous honor, and I'm really thrilled that you're here on the show today so we can congratulate you.
Oh, well, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. I appreciate that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is among those regional papers that still invest in having a reporter in Washington and it definitely takes a village. My predecessor, Tamar, I wouldn't be able to do what I do if people like Tamar weren't there to help and guide me. I lean on her so much, y'all don't even know. So thank you so much. It is an honor, and I appreciate all the love I've received from back in Georgia.
Well, all right. Election is really heating up to a boiling point right now. Tamar, why don't we go ahead and start about talking about the early vote at this point. As of yesterday, the end of voting yesterday, close to a half a million people, 416,558 people have voted early. 42% of them were taking Democratic ballots. 57% took Republican ballots. But I've said it before, the thirst for getting out to vote is extraordinary right now, Tamar.
I mean, it's hard to get away from it. You know, the stakes are so massive, as everyone will say, and there's such different visions for kind of how the state should be led. So it's not surprising to me at all that such a rush of people have been coming out, especially amid all the uncertainty of what our new elections law is going to look like. So it doesn't surprise me that people want to vote early, just kind of get it out of the way. What's even more interesting, as we're going to talk about, is the number of Democrats or people who have voted Democratic as recently as 2020 who have pulled Republican ballots this cycle, and what that might say about the state of Georgia politics right now.
Yeah, Tia, although his numbers are now a couple of days old, your colleague Mark Nisi, who follows elections for the AJC, had a report the other day in which he said that about 7% of people who 2 years ago pulled Democratic ballots this year are pulling Republican ballots, and that number has probably gone up considerably, because at that point I think he was looking at a pool of only 240 or so thousand total voters. So that may be continuing. The Purdue people are arguing that those are people crossing over voting for David Perdue. I'm not sure that's much more than wishful thinking on their part.
Yeah, and I anecdotally heard from an AJC reader who says that Democrats are crossing over to pull Republican ballots, in particular in some of these races where not just the governor's race, but, you know, some of these congressional races. I wrote earlier this week about Representative Adam Kinzinger, who's from Illinois, but he has a PAC that's encouraging people, particularly in the 14th district, to cross over and select one of those other Republicans on the primary against Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance. So, Mark didn't divide it up by, you know, zip code or anything like that, but I think we might find there are pockets of this happening. In addition, that's always been something that people in Metro Atlanta have done. You know, Carolyn Bordeaux was criticized in the debate for doing that 1 year when she crossed over, because she was worried about the rise of Donald Trump. I believe that was 2016, I believe, that she, or 2012 maybe. But anyways, there was a presidential year where Carolyn Bordeaux pulled a Republican ballot because she said she was worried about extremism. As we know, if you're in Metro Atlanta, the Democrats are usually safe in the primary, so you've always heard that happening sometimes where there's more action on the Republican side. So it'll be interesting to see where these voters are coming from as the, you know, once the primary concludes.
Margaret, I should have pointed out that, of course, you're down there in Savannah, and the Current sees as its first responsibility covering coastal Georgia, the politics and the news of coastal Georgia, and I should have mentioned that when I introduced you. So you're not sure whether there's much of that going on down your way, right?
Yeah, well, we, in our weekly newsletters this morning, Tuesdays, we put out our political newsletter. And one of our segments is the actual low numbers of turnout here along the 8 or 9 districts that make up the first district of Georgia here in coastal Georgia. Only approximately 7% of coastal Georgians registered to vote have actually voted early. And that, like, as a whole, is an incredibly low number. So, I'm not sure that there's a lot of crossover voting happening. I'm not sure there's a lot of voting happening altogether. The numbers sort of show that around here. But, you know, we have the majority minority county, Liberty County, where about 8% of registered voters have voted early. Here in Chatham County, which is, of course, Savannah and our environment, we have one of the largest growing municipalities in Georgia, in Pooler. Savannah, of course, is majority minority, but still only 6.6% of registered voters have voted here in early voting. So there, I don't know, you know, how these numbers are all going to break down by next Tuesday night, but there still is a lot of ground game left. If candidates who think that they're losing right now, if there's a lot of room to get people out to vote in order to get them over the finish line.
That's really, it strikes me as particularly interesting because I'm not sure there's a rationale why the numbers would be lower down along the coast than in much of the rest of the state, Margaret.
Yeah, I think that there's probably, there's not a whole lot of excitement on the Democratic side because you don't have a gubernatorial primary. You know, here in the first district, we have our longstanding incumbent, Representative Buddy Carter, is running unopposed on the Republican side. We have a really dynamic race for the Democratic primary. And so people might still be making up their mind about who they want to vote for that race. But otherwise, we're talking about, you know, I think state senators, we're talking about school boards. And in a midterm year, it's hard to get people excited about local races, especially first-time candidate races, where communities might not know who the people are who want to represent us.
I think that's important that you point that out. And Tamar, that actually leads us into a topic that I'm really interested in hearing all of you discuss. Tamar, we know that Republicans are voting in larger numbers, or we imagine, because they do have some competitive races. I mean, particularly David Perdue against Brian Kemp, whereas, you know, Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock are at the top of the Democratic ticket unopposed. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening with the split in the Republican Party, the state Republican Party, between Perdue and Kemp. Kemp has been getting support. He's building momentum. George W. Bush has now endorsed him, the former president, the governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, who also is fighting with Donald Trump because Trump wanted Ducey to overturn the results of the Arizona presidential election. There, he was in town in the state to endorse Brian Kemp. We've got the Speaker of the House, David Ralston, who used to be at odds with Kemp, giving him a warm endorsement. And meanwhile, Newt Gingrich is back in the state promoting David Perdue. So the split between among Republicans, the pro-Trump and the Trump skeptics, I think it's safe to say, continues right down to the end of the election tomorrow.
Absolutely. And very critically, Mike Pence is going to be coming in to stump for Brian Kemp, not David Perdue. You know, Donald Trump's chosen person on the eve of election day. So that's absolutely notable. You know, who we haven't seen, though, is Donald Trump recently, who is, of course, David Perdue's kind of ace card. And what's been interesting is we haven't seen a ton of David Perdue lately, not as much on the trail, not nearly as much as what we've seen from Brian Kemp, who's been making, you know, a half dozen stops each day. And, you know, Perdue are much more kind of spread apart. We're not seeing him on the airwaves in the way that we're seeing Brian Kemp, who needs to deliver a knockout punch. And it's looking likelier and likelier in polls that very well could happen. David Perdue's hope right now is to be able to pull Kemp into a runoff on June 21st. And, you know, just runoffs here are historically unpredictable. But right now, the posture that Brian Kemp seems to be running on is that, you know, it's increasingly looking likely.
Tia, we know there are five candidates running for governor. Obviously, only Perdue and Kemp are getting real attention. But five Republicans running, which is where David Perdue's hope lies. But as Tamar just pointed out, The Jolt this morning reports that Perdue had one event over the weekend that journalists know about. And maybe there were other things going on that weren't reported out. Whereas Brian Kemp made at least five stops on the campaign trail. And also, as Tamar points out, Tia, there's no ad buy-up for Perdue in these final days of the race, probably because we know he hasn't raised a great deal of money.
Right. And it's also interesting, you know, Brian Kemp is holding kind of bigger events open to the public, whereas Perdue is having smaller events just with GOP groups, you know, like the county GOP and things like that. So even the scope of their events is different. The quantity of their events is different. And then, of course, their ad spend, you know, it looks right now that Kemp is a surging candidate. He's also, as you noted, has his, you know, surrogates coming. More surrogates keep announcing that they're coming. And then you've got, again, so far, Donald Trump, not only has he not come to Georgia lately, but it seems that he's made statements that he's kind of almost hedging and, you know, avoiding talking up some of his candidates that look like they might not win in the primary. And that's something we've seen him do, not just in Georgia, but, you know, he doesn't like losing. And there is a chance that one or more of his endorsed candidates could be out on, you know, a week from today.
Margaret?
Yeah, I'm not so sure what I take away from the fact that Perdue isn't holding public events. Because he's speaking to his own choir. He is on Newsmax. He is on OAN. He is on all of the right-wing media channels. And those, the people that he believes in Georgia will come out and vote for him are watching those channels. It is very time efficient and very cost efficient to get free media attention by being interviewed by people like us. And so I think that he and his team have a strategy. They're not going to change people's minds in Georgia at this point, but they need people to turn out to vote for them. You know, his I think his performance at the gubernatorial primary debates was rather extraordinary. You know, for the stoic, silent Sea Island resident that we all know in coastal Georgia, he was full of fire and brimstone, right? I mean, he probably has motivated people who are voting Republican, who are fueled by outrage, to go out and vote for him because of those performances. So I know the polls have him down. I just think that we all need to wait until the end of Tuesday and figure out exactly how many people in Georgia actually believe in his vision instead of Brian Kemp's vision, or Trump's vision versus Brian Kemp's vision.
You know, our friend, I should point out, and frequent panelist, WRBL-TV's Chuck Williams, interviewed Drew Ferguson, the 3rd District Republican congressman, the other day. And he said, Drew Ferguson said, he believes that Perdue's campaign is tomorrow, quote, on life support. That's not something you really, now I get it. Drew Ferguson is, I assume, supporting Brian Kemp, so it makes sense he might want to say that. But it's still something to hear that in the days before the final day of voting.
And pretty extraordinary to me as somebody who covered the congressional delegation in Washington. Drew Ferguson and David Perdue used to be allied, and it just goes to show how much this primary has ripped apart and kind of burned down a lot of bridges with traditional allies. And look, I agree with Margaret in saying we, you know, it's not over till it's over. And at this moment, what David Perdue needs to do is just make sure that Brian Kemp gets less than 50% of the vote. Runoffs are so unpredictable here in Georgia, as Brian Kemp can attest to in 2018. So much can change over the course of only a couple weeks. So as long as he can keep the governor under 50%, you know, we can't answer any questions, you know?
Margaret?
Yeah, so, you know, in the smaller elite world of campaign strategists in Georgia, of course, there are people who are thrilled about what their internal polls are saying right now, especially if you're a Republican strategist. But I think that from all of the, you know, the ire and the shade that people are throwing against each other, I just really think that those same political consultants have their work cut out for them after the primary, having to figure out how you go around the state and campaign on what's going to be a mixed ideological Republican ballot. How are Kemp and Herschel Walker going to campaign together? How is anyone who's not a Kemp person at the top of the ballot going to be able to go with the governor around the state and try and build a coalition of Republicans in order to win in November?
That's a great, great point. Tia?
Yeah, I agree. It's a great point because we know that the blueprint for Republicans to win statewide in 2022 in a swing state is to drop Trump for the general election and to focus on issues that can drive turnout. That still means you don't have to drop the culture wars, because we know the culture wars drive turnout. But it knows that if you focus too much on Trump, if you let it be about the 2020 election, that's something. For example, the Glenn Youngkins of the world, he did not focus on Trump. He did not campaign with Trump. He did not talk about the 2020 election. He talked about what he perceived as parents and people in the middle caring about. And so, to Michelle's point, are those candidates going to be able to do that? Is Herschel Walker, we see he's been trying to do that, and it looks like he's been successful. We know Kemp has been doing that, and he has been successful. But further down the ballot, if Jody Heiss is the, you know, nominee for Secretary of State, can they do that? And then, therefore, can they campaign as a ticket? It's looking very likely that a very MAGA candidate is going to win the GOP's nomination for lieutenant governor. Are they going to pivot? Will they pivot? And how will that affect them being able to campaign as a ticket? That's a very good question.
And it's why we're not going to run out of things to talk about on Political Rewind through the end of the year. Tia, while the ball's in your court, let's talk about the other side of the primaries. While we know, again, Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock at the top of the ticket run unopposed, there are active campaigns going on for Secretary of State, for Attorney General, and others. The Democratic Party had its first state gala since 2019 last weekend. And Senator Amy Klobuchar came down from Minnesota. She, of course, was a candidate for president 4 years ago. She urged Democrats something they're already well aware of and starting to do, and it gives us a chance to move to this topic. She said, you've got to run on the right to choice. It is going to animate voters. And Stacey Abrams, Tia, has already turned her health care message toward that and is including that as part of her campaign strategy.
Yeah, and again, because kind of similar to the point I just made, we know that turnout is going to be key for the general election in a swing state like Georgia. And candidates on both sides are looking at issues they think will turn out voters. And, you know, on the Republican side, it might be schools and COVID policy and attacking Democrats on inflation and gas prices. On the Democratic side, it's going to be, you know, abortion. Now it's going to be domestic terrorism and white supremacy and white nationalism. You know, there are these key issues that Democrats think can entice voters in the middle to side with them.
Tamar, you filed a piece on how Republicans, how many Republicans in Georgia, who used to be a little bit cautious about how far they went in opposing abortion rights, how they're moving to the extreme right on this issue. Talk about what you learned when you reported that story.
Sure. I mean, as recently as a few years ago, even among, you know, anti-abortion activists, there were still some that were hesitant to advocate for a policy that would ban all abortions, no exceptions for rape and incest. Now that's becoming increasingly popular, hardline, no exceptions at all. And we're seeing candidates like David Perdue vouch for stuff like that. You're even seeing folks running for races that have nothing to do whatsoever with abortions, like Jody Heiss running for Secretary of State, who are also advocating for that really hardline policy. And you're seeing that even some of these candidates are going farther than even some of these longtime anti-abortion advocates have been saying. And maybe it's just because the playing field has shifted so rapidly. I think everyone kind of assumes that Roe versus Wade would still be the law of the land, and maybe it would be too much to ask for an outright ban, no exceptions. But in order to win these primaries, all these conservative candidates are really trying to up their street cred with the base.
But Margaret, it feels to me that since we are going to end up having general elections there are Republicans and Democrats who are moving in the wrong directions on how they approach choice. So what I mean by that is, as Tamar just pointed out, we have Republicans who are moving all the way to total bans on abortion, promoting that idea. On the other hand, Margaret, when the Senate voted last week, led by Chuck Schumer, on their right to choice bill, it went all the way in the opposite direction. And we know that most Americans do support the right to choice with certain limitations. The Senate didn't take those limitations into consideration. So it feels like both sides are moving in directions that are not supported by most Americans.
Yep, we are living in a time and place in America where coalition building seems to be, you know, a historic relic. And getting attention on the 24-hour media news cycle means you have to say things that are outrageous and get you 15 minutes or even 15 seconds or give you a, you know, three-sentence, you know, explainer on a news channel's crawl. But that's why Americans are getting so, you know, outraged about the state of politics in America. You know, what we're hearing in terms of headlines isn't reflective of our daily lives, our daily needs, and our daily priorities. And since we are all, your panel today are all three women, you know, I think we can all safely say that an abortion ban isn't going to end abortions in America. It's going to make abortions more unsafe for people who need it. And if you... And if politicians would actually look at the polls instead of looking to their base, we might actually find some common sense solutions to both health problems, economic problems, and social problems that we all face.
Tia, I want to give you a chance to weigh in, but let me point something out. I mentioned it on the show a few weeks ago. If, in fact, the Supreme Court goes ahead with this decision, this opinion that we've seen leaked now, and turns this notion of choice back to states, we are going to see wars on the scale among states not seen since the Fugitive Slave Acts were passed in the days of the Civil War. It's an extraordinary thing to think about, Tia.
Yeah, and I just was going to make the point that abortion rights is an economic issue. The strides that women have made in the workplace, the changes in the balance of many family units with two parents working, with women sometimes being the breadwinner. There is a direct correlation to that and abortion rights, abortion access. So I'm not saying that every woman who's prospering in the workplace had an abortion. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying as a general kind of study, those who study economics say abortion access has played a role in strides women have made, and therefore curtailing abortion access will likely have a negative role because there will be more women who have babies who otherwise may not have because they don't have that access or can't afford it. And that's something we should keep in mind.
All right. Thank you for a great start to the show today, all of you. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we have to address how people are reacting here in Georgia, particularly to the horrific mass shooting in Buffalo over the weekend. We'll do that more as Political Rewind continues.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Margaret Coker, Tamar Halderman, Tia Mitchell join us for today's Political Rewind. Tia, you filed a story the other day giving us reaction from Georgia political leaders to the awful, awful mass shooting in Buffalo over the weekend. Give us a little sense of what you learned.
So, you know, I wanted it to be organic, so I kind of culled their social media posts right after the shooting, you know, those first 24 hours. And what we saw was that when it came to Republicans, many Republicans didn't say much at all. But those who did, the strongest statement came from Governor Kemp, who actually not only said, you know, he was heartbroken about the shooting, but said eliminate, eradicate hate. Other Republicans, said, you know, our heart is broken, or even Vernon Jones made it a non sequitur about inner city violence. Democrats therefore were much more likely to talk directly about where that hate came from, not just hate, but racism, domestic terrorism, white nationalism. That's something you have not heard from many Republicans, and those who have said that, the Liz Cheneys and the Adam Kinzingers, are those who are kind of on the outs with the party. And so that's been very interesting to see that partisan divide, even in talking about what appears to be, you know, what motivated this young man to target black people in a black neighborhood.
Tamara, I think we need to pick up on that. First of all, it's not surprising that a Lucy McBath, who came into politics because of the tragic murder of her own son, as a very strong supporter of gun regulations, would be deeply involved in this right now. But as Tia points out, Democrats have also looked at the racist motivations behind this crime, and are also talking about Republicans' refusal to stand up to white supremacist thinking.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen similar debates after every mass shooting that seems to happen with increased frequency in this country, right? You know, Republicans in Georgia have shown that they're moving in the other direction when it comes to guns. They want fewer limitations on the right to own and carry firearms. And as we saw with the bill that was signed into law by the governor this spring, it also becomes tricky when you're talking about white supremacy, you know, because you obviously you don't want extremism in your party, but also, you know, there's some version of what has been said, especially when it comes to like immigration and not want, you know, wanting to tamp down on immigration into the country, that is in their platform sometimes. I mean, not as extreme as what is being espoused by the gunman in Buffalo, but still, so it's a tricky situation. And many of those people on the right, you know, are their primary voters. So you have to be careful.
Margaret?
You know, before I came home to Georgia full time in 2019, I spent over 10 years covering counterterrorism. And that mostly was foreign terrorism, right? Because the U.S., after the September 11th attacks in 2001, passed the Patriot Act, which had definitions for what a foreign terrorist group was and had criminal penalties for supporting foreign terrorism groups. So what is, I think, applicable right now in America is that we do not have criminal penalties for domestic terrorism and supporting domestic terrorism groups. That is absent from our criminal legal statutes. And so we're in this strange bind where we have a push by Americans to expand gun rights without a counter argument about people who are clearly motivated by what we would all agree are hateful ideologies. And there is no way to really censure both individuals who commit hate crimes from a terrorism perspective, the people who support groups who promote hate crimes as a terrorism perspective. And so the FBI and other law enforcement agencies have to deal with suspected murderers as murderers instead of terrorists. If we have a nationwide push to think about domestic terrorism and white supremacy and neo-Nazi groups as terrorism, we might have different outcomes when it comes to tragedies like this.
Tia?
There is, that's a great point, and I just wanted to point out two things. Number one, there is a domestic terrorism bill that now appears to be gaining some traction in the House. They're trying to make it bipartisan to address that. And I think on a related note, I just want to kind of encourage the people listening to not be so quick to say, well, that was just one crazy guy. That was a lone wolf. There really isn't such a thing as a lone wolf, because they were radicalized somewhere, usually. They were on message boards somewhere, usually. They have been watching the posts, sharing the memes, attending the meetings that led them to this point, sometimes with direct encouragement to participate in violence, to participate in the genocide of Jewish people, immigrants, Black people, Latinos. So it's so quick. I think people, because they want to, either for their own political reasons or because it's just scary to consider the alternative, people are so quick to say, well, that's just one crazy person. No, this was all the evidence that has surfaced thus far indicates the young man, he was only 18, but that he had been shaped and shifted by the far right white nationalist movement online. He was not a lone wolf.
And of course, Tamar, what motivated him apparently more than anything else was this so-called replacement theory, which in fact has become a talking point of mainstream Republicans. Not all of them, I want to be careful about, but some. Elise Stefanik, now the number three Republican in the U.S. House, has spoken about it. She says the plan of Democrats is to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants to overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. And she takes Liz Cheney's place as the third Republican in the House. And Liz Cheney has been saying, we have to speak out against this sort of thing. Marjorie Taylor Greene attended an event last year with a right-wing group that believes that replacement theory is real. So we do have to point out that this is gaining traction among what we think of as formerly mainstream Republicans.
Yeah, and I mean, Tucker Carlson on the show every night on Fox News, perhaps I believe the highest rating show on rated show on cable news right now, the topic he discusses regularly too. And I think it's a touchy subject for Republican lawmakers too, because you don't want to accept responsibility for that, right? You don't want to have to, you know, take responsibility for that. And folks are wary of kind of shifting their rhetoric or taking any blame for that. So it becomes a really uncomfortable situation.
All right. This is going to be a story that we're going to be following. President Biden goes to Buffalo to express his condolences, to speak about this awful crime, and we'll certainly pay attention to that. You'll hear about it later today on All Things Considered. But we still have other subjects we want to address, and so let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back and talk about more. Margaret Coker, who, by the way, you can read at thecurrentga.org if you want to read The Current. Margaret, race is never far from the headlines in America today. And in Georgia right now, there's an ongoing case that is troubling a great many people. It took place down in Liberty County. The Delaware State University women's lacrosse team, the bus that they were going on came through Liberty County. They were stopped by sheriff's police, and they were then all made to get off the bus. Their luggage was searched. It was an African American. It's an HBCU, and so the team was all Black. And there are those who believe that this stop and the subsequent search and scrutiny paid to these young women was primarily because they're Black, and the sheriff, the officer who stopped him, was white. And it's there's an investigation now underway, Margaret.
That's right. So again, for your listeners in other parts of Georgia, Liberty County is a majority minority county just south of Savannah. You know, the ribbon of I-95 that goes from South Carolina down the Georgia coast to Florida, it is full of truckers. It is full of speeding drivers. It's full of Sunday drivers sometimes as well. But it is a gnarly place to figure out ways in which to get to your destination in a timely fashion. Sheriff's deputies routinely patrol 95, and they routinely pull people over. Now, the circumstances of this traffic stop seems to have some merit, at least on the face of it. The bus was traveling in the left-hand passing lane, and there's when 18-wheelers and other large vehicles move into the left lane, that generally is frowned upon. And so what the outrage seems to be surrounding is not the original traffic stop, but the way in which the sheriff's deputies handled the busload of young women, athletes, and their coaches, and the Black bus driver as well. And so this the sheriff of Liberty County is a Black man. He has said to the press that he doesn't believe there was a racial motivation for the original traffic stop, but the handling of the subsequent search of the bus and everyone's belongings is really now under scrutiny. So we'll see what the investigation holds, but of course, in coastal Georgia, in the aftermath of the Ahmaud Arbery murder, you know, everyone is looking at this part of Georgia through a racial lens and through, you know, the prism of America's racial reckoning.
And Tia, the sheriff himself is African American, as we said. I think there were two officers who conducted the search, looking, they said, for drugs, were white. But of course, the point of all this is, Tia, whatever the outcome, we are always on edge about race in this country. We cannot escape it.
And I want to quibble a little bit with your word choice, because sometimes the perception is that, or the accusation is, Black people are always playing the race card and we make everything about race. And so, you know, that it puts white people on edge because Black people are always injecting race into things where race doesn't exist. But I want to, maybe my point
well,
is
wait,
to get
wait,
the...
No, I really have to stop for a second, because that was not in, I understand how you interpreted that. I was not suggesting that. I was suggesting that Black people and white people continue to have this terrible tension over issues of race.
Right.
It is not one race or the other.
Right.
I really want to make that clear.
Yeah,
but go
ahead. And I was going to say, maybe I'm not quibbling with your word choice as much as I want to say, to give you a perspective as a Black woman, that
sure,
it's hard because we don't drop our race. We can't hide our race. Race is a part of every single thing we do. So every time you're stopped, we instantly have to calculate within a millisecond, how could our race play a part in this interaction with the police? If we're in a store and a clerk comes up to us and says, may I help you? We are instantly having a conversation in our head about what perhaps could be the racial implication of this interaction. So it's not, so I know you weren't trying to make it a thing. I'm just trying to give the Black perspective. We can't drop race. We can't avoid the conversation of race because it permeates every single thing we're doing on every single day. It's not necessarily that it's negative, but it's part of what is in our mind no matter what. And therefore, interactions with police, we're constantly calibrating. Is it because I'm Black? And that is what makes it harder, because you don't know. Think about that. Think about the mind games it plays with you when you can't tell whether you didn't get the job because you weren't qualified or because someone judged you based on your name or the color of your skin. And we may never know, but we know that what it feels like on the inside. So that's the point I want to make. Those young ladies on that bus may never be told, yes, it was because of your race, or yes, we have proof, but they know how it felt in that moment. And they know that they had no drugs. And how does a man driving a bus? We know in a charter bus, you don't even know the driver most of the time. So why would the driver's infraction lead to a search of these college students' luggage? And they know how that felt. And they know they're Black.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you for saying that. Tamar?
I completely understand, especially, I mean, just look at the headlines in the last couple of years. I mean, look at Ahmaud Arbery, look at what happened in Buffalo. It's not like the frequency of all of this racially motivated violence is going away.
Margaret?
Yeah, you know, last year we at The Current were looking into, policing and implicit bias, largely in Glenn County, but across coastal Georgia counties as well. And, you know, what we kept hearing over and over again from Black residents, but and also police officers, is this tension with police comes to the forefront most often because police come to situations with a warrior mentality. Instead of actually treating people that they pull over or treating people as neighbors, they treat them as potential enemies and potential threats. And let's face it, in terms of a traffic stop, like that is not something that should trigger a red alert or a DEFCON 5. And if that's the way, you know, the snippets of video that we have from the bus that were taken by the young women athletes show that there was a hostility from the get-go when the white sheriff's deputies entered the bus. And a presumption of guilt, a presumption that you are carrying contraband of any sort, should not be the first interaction that anyone has with police, especially since there for the people on the bus, there was no underlying reason why they should be seen through that prism.
Margaret, on the theme of our inability to reconcile this country's history of racism, I want to talk just for a couple minutes about a story that you posted on The Current. It turns out that a search of the city of Savannah's municipal archives shows that in your reporter working with Georgia Southern University worked to put together an exhibition, an online exhibition, Jim Crow in Savannah's Parks, examining how Savannah denied black people access to the best public parks and recreational facilities, but that it was black taxpayers who paid for those superior park systems. Just give us a couple minutes about that, and people will post a link to that story.
Yeah, thanks for drawing attention to this. It's a really fascinating and incredibly educational project. The, you know, Savannah, Georgia's first city, loves its history. We have a great municipal archivist and archives program. And there has been an intern from Georgia Southern who has been digging into city archives with a lens towards racial justice and segregation. And Savannah has this long, proud history of having integrated our schools and our municipal governments very peacefully. And of course, Martin Luther King praised Savannah's black population for coming and registering to vote in enormous numbers, more than any other southern city back in the early days of voting rights and civil rights. So to have this this forgotten history of Savannah come out in an incredibly engaging visual illustration of how white leaders from the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, all the way up through the 60s were really pushing a intentional policy of segregation in city parks and city recreational facilities is eye-opening, it's sobering, and it's it reminds us all that you know, history will repeat itself unless we know our history better.
We will post a link because it's a really fascinating and necessary story for people to read. Tia, we're running out of time, but before we leave, we got a week till the final day of voting, May 24th. What are you going to be looking at? What do you think are going to be the races that are of most interest to you in the week ahead?
So me personally, I'm focused mostly on our congressional races. We have some interesting primaries, you know, the 10th in Vernon Jones. Will he be able to at least make it to the runoff? We have, you know, the 6th, which is now an open seat in a contested Republican primary. In the 7th, the McBath versus Bordeaux race. In the 2nd, we're going to see which Republican is going up against Sanford Bishop. And of course, you know, at the top of the ticket, the Senate, the governor, it's going to be an exciting day.
Yeah. Tomorrow, what do you want to look for? Whether you're going to actually cover these races or not, what's of interest to you?
I'm really fascinated by the Republican Secretary of State's race. All the polls have suggested that Brad Raffensperger will be pulled into a runoff with Jody Heiss, a man that who Tia and I covered closely in Washington. You know, Jody Heiss, of course, has put questioning of the 2020 election kind of at the center of his bid. I'll be curious to see how much support he gets. And of course, Tia mentioned it, but the 7th District Democratic primary between McBath and Bordeaux, two very different kind of philosophies when it comes to being a Democrat. You know, will the more centrist candidate win? Will the more liberal candidate kind of focused on gun control win? I'll be very curious.
Margaret, meanwhile, today we have big elections, certainly in Pennsylvania, where people are going to be watching to see whether Mehmet Oz, the Trump endorsed candidate there actually can pull it off. It appears that he's struggling a little bit. That's going to be close. And North Carolina, where Madison Cawthorn is up for re-election, Trump is late, has given him a late endorsement. He's a very controversial candidate. Here's going to be another day we're going to watch to see the power of Trump a week before we learn what it's like here in Georgia.
Yeah, and you know, talk about you know a present for Democrats. If Mehmet Oz actually pulls us out, you know, he personifies so many contradictions of the Republican Party. He is an immigrant. He is a Muslim. He also has said he's not going to give up his Turkish citizenship, and if it means he's elected, and that creates all kinds of national security issues surrounding him. So it's going to be fascinating to see who Republicans in Pennsylvania choose.
We'll get a chance to take a look at those races on our show tomorrow. In the meantime, by the way, you know, yesterday, if you weren't with us, we did an hour with David Gergen, Patricia Murphy, and I. He's got a brand new book out, advisor to four U.S. presidents, senior analyst on CNN. Fascinating book about great leaders and what makes great leaders. If you get a chance, you want to listen to the podcast. We really enjoyed talking to David. That's it for us for today. Margaret Coker, Tia Mitchell, Tamar Hallerman. What a great conversation. Thank you all so much for being here for Political Rewind. We're back again tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Take care. Please stay healthy. Bye, everybody.